paper.
Welcome to episode 38 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Lynn Suries, a Maryland-based artist who works with handmade paper in a variety of ways. Lynn tells me how she first discovered that paper was made by hand while reading the book Papermaking by Dard Hunter, and that she assumed that nobody on earth made paper by hand anymore. She was wrong. We talk about her teaching philosophy and her work with pulp painting, and we discuss the paper she makes to draw on. She says if you make your own paper, it isn't scary to draw on a blank sheet. She describes one paper she took to Africa with her on a Smithsonian Artist Research Fellowship. Lynn has spearheaded several unique papermaking efforts, including the Pulparazzi and the National Collegiate Handmade Paper Art Triennial. And she was recently elected president of the Friends of Dard Hunter, a national papermaking organization that was founded to preserve Dard Hunter's collection and currently meets annually in a different part of the country. Enjoy our conversation. Lynn Suries, welcome to Paper Talk.
Hi, thank you, Helen.
Yeah, I think I've known you for almost 20 years, but when we just see each other at conferences, we don't have a time to get into deep conversation. So I'm really looking forward to diving deeper into your work today, your work with paper. So tell me a little bit about how you got interested in paper.
Well, because I went to art school and did printmaking and drawing. And,
where was that?
I went to the University of Maryland. Mm-hmm. In College Park, Maryland, and got my MFA. And all the work that I did, much of the work I was doing towards my MFA was works on paper. So, you know, I appreciated that paper was something that contributed to what I was doing. And I read this book called Papermaking by someone named Dard Hunter. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, how interesting. So this is how paper was once made. But I just assumed that no one on earth made paper by hand any longer.
Right.
So, you know, I didn't like pursue that or anything. And it was just sort of happenstance then that I was teaching an etching class for the Smithsonian Associates in a nearly condemned building in Washington, D.C. And right after that, there was a papermaking class being taught. And so that became my awareness of papermaking. And when I got hired the following year to teach at the Corcoran College of Art and Design in D.C., I was able to use their papermaking studio to start experimenting. And then that led to a fluke exhibition in Baltimore at the Museum of Art.
Let's back up just a little bit. So you just learned by experimenting. Did you take any classes?
No, I took one class with the papermaking teacher, who was Georgia Deal.
Okay.
And so I learned these basics of, you know, this is pulp and you can mix pigments into pulp and all this kind of rudimentary stuff, mm-hmm. which actually didn't interest me, I have to admit, until, you know, like I say, I went to art school. I was trained as a painter and printmaker. And when I realized, oh, you can paint with this stuff if you figure out how to make the pigments adhere to the pulp. So that was actually the moment that I got interested, and that's what I started experimenting with at the Corcoran for, you know, a couple of years until I realized I had to have my own studio to pursue this. And, you know, one thing led to another. So now I have a full papermaking studio, and, you know, that I work with here.
Right. And what is that? Is that at your house, or do you have a separate studio?
It's at my house. I've always, for my whole career, felt like it was a lot easier for me because I have two children. Mm-hmm. And when they were little, it was so tricky to find moments to work. Right. I wasn't, you know, in a position to be getting in the car and going somewhere to have studio time. So it was always kind of like walking through the magic doors and into my studio. Then I never felt like I was home at that point. I was in right. the studio. So yeah, that's what happened. I don't remember what were we talking about that led into this, or should it matter?
No, that's okay. Well, you were telling me about your first show, I think.
Oh yeah. I put work into the Maryland Art Registry, Maryland State Arts Council Registry, which everyone does. Mm-hmm. And the handmade paper pieces that I was working on got noticed by the curators, and I ended up being, you know, in this 4-person exhibition there. But I really should say also that the most important influences on my papermaking, on the ability that I have to do what I want to do with pulp painting and papermaking in general, were Rick Hungerford with his ability to pigment, and Elaine Koretsky and Donna Koretsky with their book, Color for the Hand Paper Maker. Those saved me from just being someone who would never have understood the chemistry and how to make the pulp behave, into someone who's perfectly comfortable with it. And pulp painting has been a huge thing for me throughout my whole career.
Right. And you mentioned Rick Hungerford, who really has a way of refining pulp.
Yeah.
Did you take a workshop with him? Or?
I should also thank then Helen Frederick for, you know, having Pyramid Atlantic under her right. wing for so many years.
Which is in D.C.
Which is in the D.C. area. It's always been usually been in Maryland. But Helen, had this wonderful operation of the paper and print studio at Pyramid. And so Rick went there, and I assisted him on a weekend workshop, which meant that I got to kind of see what was going on and help, even though, you know, I wouldn't call what I was doing super professional, even though I'd had, you know, I didn't know the workings of papermaking as well as I later would. And so, that weekend workshop with Rick was really important, as you say, for refining the pulp, and then also then for understanding something about pigmenting instead of kind of nothing about pigmenting.
Right, right. And so let's stay on this learning and teaching for a moment. Because I was thinking about how, there's not a lot of places to learn paper making. Certainly there are more and more, hopefully, and more in the future. Yeah. But in terms of your teaching, I'm curious about both at the Corcoran, and then I know you do a lot of other workshops, how you approach teaching people paper making. So I guess at the college level, it's a more basic getting to know it.
Yeah, at the college level, and also, well, let's just stick with that for a second. At the college level, I feel like I want to not have other people have to go through all of the incredibly steep learning curve I had to go through, when I can just say, look, if you do this like this and it feels like that, that's what you're looking for, and that means it's fibrillated and it'll, you know, bond well and it'll accept pigment well in another case. And, you know, teaching people as much as I can about the behavior of pulp, that one pulp fiber can have many, many chameleon identities, from sheet forming through pigmenting for drawing or painting, et cetera, through high shrinkage for sculpture. So I try to make sure that they understand that because, you know, frankly, I think of papermaking as a tool. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that paper is beautiful. If it's, you know, handmade, it's almost invariably very alluring and all. But, you know, for me, I think of myself as somebody who makes things, and I use paper making as a tool to help me make the things that I need to make. So like if I couldn't make handmade paper, I would still investigate all of the conceptual things that attract my attention, but I would use materials that didn't involve paper making. But I find paper making a really great asset for a lot of the things I want to make.
Right, so, right. And we'll get to talking to about your work, but this intrigues me.
The teaching.
Yeah, and the approach, because I teach also, and I love to share ideas. And so are you saying that you would focus on a particular fiber like that?
I would try to disabuse students of any notion of anyone who says you have to do this and you have to do that. And that pretty much permeates all of my teaching anyway. I pretty much say, don't believe me, test it, see if it works for you. But like, say I'm, you know, I'll be teaching a workshop at Penland this coming summer in 2019. What am I going to do? I tend to be less focused on one technique and one problem than to sort of hand students, you know, say we have 5 days, I'll give them 5 demos of things that may or may not ever come together in their studio practice. But something there is going to grab them. Mm-hmm. And then the next week, they may be focused almost entirely on just pursuing that. So I really try to have a lot of confidence in students as artists and not try to be their cheerleader and say, you can do this. But to say, look, if you're here, it means you want to pick my brains. Here they are. Tell me what you need. And here's what I can offer you beforehand so that you get a sense of what kinds of questions you might want to ask and stuff. So that's my teaching method. Mm-hmm. Unless, I mean, if it's children, that's something different. But I basically have never really taught children except for my own. And that would be more like, here's some pulp, here's a mold and deckel, here's how I dip it. Okay, have fun.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, and you mentioned you're teaching at Penland. What other kinds of places do you have coming up that you're teaching?
Coming up, I don't know. I'm blanking.
Well, Penland's good.
Yeah. I mean, I have taught at a lot of places, at Aramont and at Haystack. Mm-hmm. Right before I go to teach at Penland, I'll be taking students to Italy for a 2-week workshop that I can tell you about.
Oh, let's talk about that. You've done that for many, many years.
Yeah, that started in 2002.
And what's it called?
It's called Fabriano Paper Print Book.
Okay. And we can find that online.
Yeah.
We'll put a link to that too.
It's on Facebook. It's on my website, which is usually a little bit more updated and all. Yeah, it's very available. Yeah, that's an interesting thing that I teach. Basically what that is teaching several techniques that I know how to teach, but I figure if people are going to Italy, the thing to offer them is learning from Italians. How do they do things? Mm-hmm. And this came about because, in 2002, I was invited to be at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival as a presenter. And that was during the Silk Road Summer Festival. And the people at the table next to me were these Italian guys. And I was the only one around that could speak Italian. So we were talking a lot.
Why do you speak Italian?
My mom spoke Italian. Oh. And I studied it for 2 years in college for my language requirement.
Okay.
And so I spoke that much Italian. Uh-huh. And I had actually taught for the University of Georgia 2 times for their Cortona program by then. So I had a little familiarity with listening to Italians when I wasn't with all the American students and stuff. So anyway, so these guys were great, and I kind of spirited them away from the presenting stage periodically to show them, here's what the White House looks like, and here's, you know, let's go in this museum so you can see something real quick while we take a break. And so we got to be friends in that short period of time. And the one of the guys was the director of the Fabriano Museum of Paper and Watermark. And one of the guys was one of the two major paper makers there at the museum.
Ah.
So the director was Giorgio Pellegrini, and he still is the director. And that coincidental meeting in time and space led to our designing a class for Americans, and really sometimes we have students from other parts of the world as well, to go to Fabriano and learn about paper there, and also some of the other book arts related pursuits that someone might go and study in Fabriano. So that's what we do. We have a wonderful binder that teaches us leather binding, and we have a fabulous etcher that does Shinkole etching with us. And then we work on papermaking with the master papermakers of the museum, and also another master papermaker who's in the city and has his own workshop studio. So the students get a lot of work with Italians. They learn things quite differently than we teach them in the United States, mm-hmm. which I find fascinating, and usually they do too. So that's the other way I teach, which means I'm translating a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And what a great opportunity to go to Italy. Everybody look up the trip. Read about it and watch the... I think there's some videos and images as well.
Yeah, on my website there are.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's dive into talking a little bit about your artwork.
Okay.
And you mentioned pulp painting, but also that you see paper as a tool. So I'm curious to hear a little bit more about your work.
Okay. Well, I do absolutely love pulp painting. Because it's painting, it really is for me. I just make a base sheet and start painting on it, using the techniques that work with that particular medium, that a lot of things I've kind of just made up because it works for me.
Right.
Or riffed on something that someone else talked about, showed me, whatever, and kind of maybe modified a little, like a cook would do.
Right.
And I've recently been playing with embossing my pulp paintings with a plastic plate that I've created a kind of a drawing on, because I've always been in love with drawing. That was like my first love of being an artist. And I've drawn, all over the world, actually. And I've decided to start figuring out how drawing can be a part of my pulp painting. So this kind of, I guess you could call it collagraph technique that I've been using lately for the past year, is really exciting for me. And it's something that I'll probably be teaching a little bit at Penland this summer. And maybe starting to open up for other people. I kind of have to figure things out enough on my own before I'm comfortable saying, here's what I would recommend to other people. Sure. So pulp painting in its more standard version, and then, which means, you know, using squirt bottles and stuff, or pulp painting just using my hands and other kinds of, you know, graphic kind of techniques, stenciling, etc. And then making sheets for drawing is really important for me, because like I say, I do so much drawing that I just simply have lost my patience drawing on other paper. I feel like, you know, it's scary to start a drawing, but if you made the paper, it's not, because you've already started.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
So that.
So I want to hear how you approach that, because I've been seeing your drawings on Facebook.
And, oh yeah.
Yeah, your papers are so unique, and so do you make like a whole batch of a certain palette? And
I do. I make a batch of paper for whatever purpose is upcoming, almost always, unless I happen to have some fiber that for some reason has to get used right away, which is almost never. Mm-hmm. But I, for example, for work on my most recent series, which I guess we can talk about in a while, I made paper out of Knauf and a little bit of pigment to approximate a kind of a very rough, fibrous surface, but at the same time, it had to be a surface I could draw on.
Right.
So it's a very particular looking paper that I made, I don't know, maybe about 40 sheets or 50 sheets of, a couple of pounds of pulp. Or maybe three. And then most recently, just very recently, I've made some paper that I wanted to approximate the look of ochre, which is a mineral. We think of, as artists, we think of ochre as like yellow ochre, that kind of goldish right. color that we use in paint. But ochre is a mineral that has a pretty wide range of color, a lot of the warm color range from, you know, yellow oranges all the way through pretty strong reds, deep reds. So I made a paper out of sisal and some pigment to approximate that because of the concept of the work that I've just started on in the past couple of months, which we can talk about later if you want. So, and that has a slightly smoother surface. It doesn't need to look as rough as the Knauf paper had to, for again more conceptual reasons.
Okay, so let's talk about that. The Knauf paper project, if you will, or series of drawings, or so why did you create that and what did it become?
Okay. Well, the Knauf paper was made because I was awarded a fellowship by the Smithsonian Institution called the Smithsonian Artist Research Fellowship. And
tell me about that process, how you got the award.
Okay.
And congratulations.
Well, thank you. You get nominated by a curator for that award, and all the people across the country and even some international people then submit images. I can't remember, I think 10 images of work that you've previously done. Mm-hmm. Without any proposal, just the review committee wants to see your work. Mm-hmm. So then from that round one, then they select people that they want to hear a proposal from.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to tell you about the Paper Library, which is a place to find resources about paper. Explore places to buy paper or take a workshop, try out my free video tutorials, and discover a growing selection of books about paper. You'll find the library at helenhebertstudio.com/paper-library. Now back to the episode.
The proposal has to be something in conjunction with the Smithsonian. It's not just like, well, I want to go to the beach right. and do watercolors or something. Right. So my project was really easy for me to plan out because it's something that I had kind of started on like 20 years ago for the very first iteration, which was that I would look in books for photographs of early human fossils and mm-hmm. kind of copy them, draw mm-hmm. them to see what they looked like and all. And then I would go down to the Smithsonian and draw the ones on display and stuff. And I had done several drawings over, let's see, it was 1996 to 7 that I did a lot of drawings like that. And then,
And those on your handmade paper back then?
Yeah, they were. I was making paper back then as well. Yeah. But they were very, very different from the drawings right. that I've done very recently. So anyway, so I proposed that I wanted to work with the scientists at the Natural History Museum on an understanding of early humans, and including like the ecology of early humans and some of the geographical information I might learn about how they lived and where mm-hmm. and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that I wanted to go with them on an expedition to Kenya to see some of the excavation sites where humans and human-related fossil remains have been found. Mm-hmm. And so I got it. I got yes. the award, the mm-hmm. fellowship, I mean. And I started the people down, the people at the Smithsonian were not the curators who had nominated me. Those were art curators. But the people at the Smithsonian that work there are people who have known my work for all this oh. time that I've been doing this drawing right. because they were interested in, you know, hey, yeah. this artist that keeps coming back here and drawing
right.
So they wanted to give me the opportunity to do this pursuit. And so they really opened up their lab to me and let me start my fellowship before even the official start of it, gave mm-hmm. me a space to work in. And so I did a lot of drawings before I ever left for Kenya. Then went to Kenya with all of them, actually. They were all the scientists that I had worked with at the Natural History Museum were in Kenya at the time that I was there, which was fabulous. Started out in Nairobi, and I drew some of the fossils that they had at the Nairobi National Museum there.
Now, when did you make the paper? Were you drawing on your paper?
Oh, right.
And why is the paper?
Thanks for pulling me back.
This is paper talk. That's okay.
Yeah. No, but the thing is, that's how this question started. And we can edit out anything from that that's way too much TMI. So as soon as I knew I was going to Kenya, as soon as I got the fellowship and had started those drawings down at the lab mm-hmm. at Natural mm-hmm. History, I knew I had to make some paper that was going to be the quintessential paper for this project. Mm-hmm. And it was, honestly, it was so exciting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not a formula kind of paper maker. I know a lot of people have very excellent results sort of by
over and over, know, yeah,
collecting data
yeah.
and doing what they do correctly. For me, it's never been something I've done, because it's like every time I want to make paper, there are other requirements for what I want. Now I right. want this, now I want that.
Right.
So it's never been that useful, even though I am very interested in understanding what I'm doing. So for some years I've at least jotted down some notes. You know, I used this kind of fiber in proportion mm-hmm. with this kind in approximately this way and all. So for the Kenoth, I knew I needed the color right, and I knew I needed the texture right. So I decided, okay, I'm going with Kenoff, even though I hardly ever have made Kenoff paper, because I just had a gut feeling about it. And I put a little bit of abaca in it to make it not just completely, I guess I never, when I've made Kenoff before, I've, it's never been like as flexible as I would like it to mm-hmm, be. Mm-hmm. So I put a little abaca in we'll call it like a binder or something, uh-huh. but the characteristic of the paper is entirely Kenoff. And then, I mean, there I am with these buckets of this pulp that I've beaten up, and I'm like messing with each bucket in the same way with pigments and kind of, I mean, as a painter, I'm really comfortable just winging it on color. So I winged it until it looked like it was going to be right.
Okay, and tell me what right is. Like, right, what were you going for? The texture and the color you've mentioned.
The texture was already right because of using the right fibers, and that was don't beat the knof too much, and don't have too much abaca in there in the
right. Pulp. But I'm more interested in your conceptual reason, like why you wanted this texture. Oh,
because it had to be Africa, which I had never been to. But it had to be the Africa that was that held, that made a place for all of those early humans, and hominins is really what the term is, because they weren't Homo sapiens, to thrive and to survive. And so it wouldn't have been an Africa like the one I went to, because when I went there, it was very much a desert where we were camped out and excavating. I wasn't excavating, of course. At the time that they worked, still, I mean, Africa was a natural place. It had all kinds of different ecosystems and stuff. And I just figured I wanted something that looked a lot like dirt, that didn't look like Maryland clay. I didn't want it red. I wanted it to look like what other people call dirt. And so I made this dirt paper. I've never said that before or thought that, but I think that's quite honest and accurate. Okay, so, and it had to be in the pigmenting just a little bit darker than I wanted my paper to be, because I knew it would dry just a little bit lighter.
Sure.
Okay, so then I made the sheets, and I was like super excited and happy about them. I made them on a Tim Moore mold that I have, one of two that I have, and the sheets are 16 inches high and 24 wide. In some cases, of course, I turn them to portrait format. And so that's the story of the knof paper. I made a portfolio that would hold it. I carried that to Kenya with me, even out into the desert, the paper in the portfolio, and I would, like, the portfolio's closed, I would open it up like this, you know, back on itself, and it would become my drawing board.
Right.
And I would clip my paper to it and get out my colored pencils and draw.
Okay, so colored pencils is what you were using.
That's what I've been using for a couple of years now. Yeah, for this whole series, it's always been either colored pencils on handmade paper or pulp painting.
Right. Okay. And so we can see images of these works on your website.
Yeah, you can. And I always post them on my Instagram as I make them. So if you want to see them, they take a while to make. So it's not like I post every day. It's more like maybe once a month, but or several weeks. But right now, I mean, I'm working on one that's of the Kenyan desert, which probably will take another 2 or 3 weeks to finish. And I just finished one and posted it the other day and started a new one.
So are you drawing and making pulp paintings simultaneously?
I draw all the time. I don't mean every day. I mean regularly, say 2 to 3 days a week. And then pulp paintings I do in sessions of making a lot of pulp and knowing I have X amount of time to use it before it starts to get moldy. So if I am pulp painting in the cooler weather, it's better. But that's not always when I am pulp painting. So sometimes I have to work a little faster. But the pulp painting, like I say, happens more in blocks.
Right. Well, and that makes sense because you have to prepare pulp.
Yeah, a lot of prep. Right. And even prepare the plates that I'm using as my collagraph plates.
Right. So, and do you draw during the time when you're pulp painting too? I'm just curious about your studio practice. Like if you still do that 2 to 3 days a week, or do you kind of...
Well, here's something interesting. I mean, I didn't mention this, but after I finished my Smithsonian Fellowship,
And how long was that? Sorry.
Those fellowships are only a couple of months.
Okay.
Formally. Mm-hmm. But mine ended up lasting a longer time because I was working before I went. Mm-hmm. But the thing was, I wasn't really finished with the project I wanted to do. And the scientists at the museum were very amenable to letting me keep working there. Mm-hmm. And I worked for a little while as a Smithsonian volunteer. But during that time, my principal advisor for my SARF project created a position for me, like he creates for scientists who have research to do at the museum in his department. So he created a position called a research collaborator or research associate. So I now have a formal 3-year appointment to the Natural History Museum as a researcher, which means I have a desk. I can request anything from their collection. I keep it as long as I need it. And I have really never stopped doing my SARF project.
Right.
And I'm not anywhere near ready to stop yet on that particular one. But that's kind of standard for me. It usually takes me several years to go through any concept I'm working on.
Right, right. Well, that's great to get a glimpse into that. What about exhibiting? Do you have shows coming up, and how about that work? Was there anything attached to that, like an exhibition attached to the research project?
There was nothing. The Smithsonian, the SARF doesn't have any interest in what you do after you do. I mean, they're like, they assume you're going to do something.
Right.
But they aren't going to be like the ones that help you show work or anything like that. Uh-huh. But what happened was I do have two shows coming up in which I'm going to be showing some of this work that we've been talking about. One will be in Rhode Island in July to August with the papermaking pulp painting collective that I'm a member of called Pulparazzi.
Oh.
And that came out of the pulp painting symposium, that we that Helen oh my gosh Helen Beck you're Helen Whitehead. That Beck Whitehead and I organized in 2010, and we just all ended up staying together and kind of working loosely together on projects. So we are having a show hosted by the Jamestown Arts Center this summer. And my work will be partly the pulp paintings that I've done for my SARF project, and partly some pulp paintings that I did for when I was a resident in Spain and Italy in 2015 summer on the theme of the mountain Montserrat, which is outside of Barcelona.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where I started to develop this collagraph embossing kind of technique. So those paintings will be on display too. And then in the fall, I have a show that I'm in at the Katzen Museum in Washington at American University, curated by Jennifer Riddell, who's at the National Gallery. And she's chosen me and two other artists who work in a way associated with science to show, in my case, paper works. And I'll be showing a really good chunk of the work that I've created for the SARF project on human origins. I'll show drawings, smaller pulp paintings that I've done in my studio, and larger pulp paintings that I did up at Carriage House Paper in Brooklyn in May of 2018.
Awesome. Good. So we'll put links to those shows in the show notes so people can find, come and see them if you're in the DC area.
Sure.
And you mentioned the in your first show, you were talking about the Pulperazzi and the Pulp Painting Symposium. So tell me how that got started and what it is.
Okay. Well, Beck Whitehead and I were putting our heads together at one point about feeling like we needed to be around other professionals and not just always show a lot of other people what we have figured out and what we know as teachers, you know. So we created a list of about, 10 people that we wanted to get together that were, we felt, experts in pulp painting in different ways. And we thought, we'll just like have everybody all together for 2 or 3 days, a symposium that's just for us, in which we'll exchange all of our own ideas with other people that have ideas to exchange with us. So that's how that was born. And we had it in San Antonio at the Southwest School, where Beck was head of papermaking. And we had people from all over the country meet there. And it was a fantastic format. We had an exhibition, we had lectures. And then for us, the biggest highlight was we just had a bunch of demonstrations in their large studio, in which we each took turns with all the time we needed to show each other how we do the work that we do. And it was all videoed by a professional videographer that Beck got a hold of in San Antonio. And so from that group meeting, that group symposium, was born the Pulperazzi. We just decided we had such a kind of inspiring time all together that we thought, well, we'll meet periodically and we'll do things together because we need to. Mm-hmm. So we've presented at meetings like Southern Graphics Council International and Friends of Dart Hunter, and we've done big demos, pretty elaborate things. When you get all of us together, it can be pretty crazy. We've had exhibitions, and we've got an exhibition, like I say, coming up in Rhode Island this summer that is going to be our first reunion in a couple of years. So we're pretty excited about that.
That's so cool. And to see how someone else does the same thing that you do, and 10 different people, that must just, I mean, that's amazing. And yeah. I'm just curious whether that video is available anywhere. I can hear people asking that question.
There are some of the videos.
Okay, so it's an actual DVD.
It's there. Well, what it is like a separate video for each person. Okay. And some of the videos have not been completed, and some of them have.
Okay.
So I can kind of confer with Beck and find out what's publicly available about, you know, those.
Okay, yeah, just keep me posted.
And let you know for sure.
All right.
And then, I mean, should we also maybe mention the watermarking symposium?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, so we did that together. So I think you and I were at the College Book Art Association meeting in Portland, and you stayed with me, and I knew about the Pulp Painting Symposium, and maybe you suggested doing a watermarking symposium. So we did that at the Oregon College of Art and Craft.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, to me, that was just a wonderful thing. It was, I mean, as you recall, we had one participant that came from England, mm-hmm. and one that came to Portland from Hawaii, and several from the East Coast, and just different areas of the country. Again, really inspiring. Watermarking is another one of those techniques that maybe has a rule book, but still there's so many deviations and so many ways to personalize the work and also push boundaries. So
right.
I thought our meeting was fantastic too.
And technology has played a big role in watermarks too. We had a couple people there who had used technology to create watermarking screens and make it more accessible.
Yeah, Brian Queen came in from Canada and he's always got something fantastic up his sleeve with technology. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And I know that you have been involved with the National Collegiate Handmade Paper Art Triennial, which is a wonderful forum for college students to show their work. And I want to hear about that. Did you start that?
Yeah, I co-founded that with Cindy Bowden, who was the director of the Paper Museum in Atlanta, the American Paper Museum. I went down there and I said, hey, Cindy, how about if we do this thing? And she was just like, sure, let's do it. Mm-hmm. So we got it organized, and that was in 1999. We had the first Collegiate Paper Triennial, and we've pretty much stuck to our schedule since then. And so it's our 20-year anniversary this year, and we're hoping to get a really good turnout of schools to exhibit. This year we're going to be showing at the University of the Arts and at the Morgan Conservatory. And we've got two other venues in discussion, so I can't quite spill the beans on those yet. But it's such a fantastic way for college students to have their work taken seriously, and at the same time, to spread people's understanding of what the possibilities are for papermaking in the arts.
Yeah, and to see it through fresh young eyes. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And it's now somehow connected to the Friends of Dard Hunter, which I know you are the new president of. So
yeah,
congratulations. And
thank you.
Both of these, that organization and the triennial fostering the exhibitions for college students, are really about keeping the tradition alive in some way. And I think you and I both share a passion for that. So I'd love to hear a little bit about what you're planning with the Friends of Dard Hunter. And I think the exhibition will be at the University of the Arts, where the Friends of Dard Hunter is meeting.
Exactly. Yeah, this is the first year. I mean, the triennial's been through several iterations of like a governance, we can call it. When I was in Chicago at Columbia College for a semester as an interim director, it happened to be the moment when it was there, so I worked with them, and I've worked with different people. Anne McCune at Rutgers was instrumental in a couple of the triennials with me. And so this year, because I was elected president of the FDH, I suggested, since I knew they were trying to find ways to expand the organization, that, you know, making a real commitment to college students would be a great way of getting the Friends, well, getting them on everybody's lips, so to speak. And so hopefully that'll help work out not only for a wonderful experience for the students in the triennial, but really to help the Friends of Dard Hunter move forward, which is honestly, that's something I feel so strong about. It's the reason I accepted this office, is because I thought, well, you know, yes, we need to look and hold on to tradition, but we really, really need to find out where papermaking is going as a group, not just one person moving this way and one moving that way, but also, you know, it's a kind of a craft treasure of our country as well as the whole world. And, you know, for our part, we can kind of set our sights to work together to kind of pull things into the future. And I'm excited to see what that looks like.
Me too. Well, Lynn, thanks so much. It's been a real treat to learn more about everything you're doing. And good luck to you.
Well, thank you, Helen. I really enjoyed talking with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at HelenHebertStudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.
The reason, besides the season, the making paper.